everybody. Hey, everybody. This is JGSF 1987.
Yeah, I know. We're going to put that
recording on here, and sorry for that. Just going through a
little bit of personal issues.
Before I go any further, I would like to remind all of you now that you can help support this podcast with a monthly contribution. Anything you can give is going to go a long way, and when, as I would like to say, it takes an advance. Okay, so dynamics that have been going on since March, actually. Well, I don't think I need to go into too much detail about Afghanistan. I think you've seen a lot of it with your own eyes. Yeah, the withdrawal from Afghanistan has been a lot messier than many of us had initially thought. I mean, no one expected the Taliban to, or at least some of the policymakers didn't exactly expect the Taliban to take Kabul as quickly as it did. Me personally, I'm not surprised by that, but that in itself is a whole different matter, basically. So, with that aside, but here's the thing. The fact is that if you look at the situation just as a whole, you shouldn't be too shocked about it either. The fact of the matter is that the Afghan central government, for basically since it was installed back in 2003, basically after the Taliban had been thrown out at, you know, close to the, at, in about October of 2001, basically. Well, the fact is that the former central government that's now completely collapsed, it was on a shaky foundation from the very beginning. It had very little legitimacy in the eyes of the Afghan people, basically, because it was basically people coming from abroad and who had no real standing in Afghanistan for quite a while. So that was why, and it was kind of also imposed on them by an outside power, so i.e. us, in the name of nation building. The mistake of engaging in nation building was made by the Bush administration that was carried out through Obama and whatnot. Trump, partially to his credit, tried to put an end to it, albeit somewhat haphazardly because he didn't have a fully developed plan when he announced the withdrawal starting, I think, last spring or last summer, basically. Where he said, where he wanted to invite the Taliban to the White House to, you know, try to discuss that and whatnot. But the problem is that the Trump administration had no plan in mind, even when they said that they would be out, you know, by May 1. But, again, not to put the entire onus on Trump, though. And, yeah, I know, I can't believe that I'm saying that myself, but that's a side note. The thing of the matter is, think of it this way. The fact is that Biden really did not have much to work with. And that was part of the problem, is that he had to develop the exit strategy basically from scratch. Because the Trump administration apparently never had one, and so... Yeah, because they never had one, there was also no means of trying to hold things together in Afghanistan either. But the Bush administration, it let its arrogance get the better of it, basically, and so And by not bringing the Afghan people into the process, the central government that was there had basically no legitimacy at all, at least in their eyes. And the fact is that, so when it collapsed to the Taliban, well, I'll put it this way, most of the, a lot of, a good chunk of the Afghan population wants nothing to do with the Taliban, basically. Or wanted nothing to do with them, especially after the Sharia, well, I wouldn't go quite as far as saying Sharia, actually. That was a mistake on my end. But imposing their very strict interpretation of Islamic law, a lot of the, let's just say a good chunk of the Afghan populace is not exactly forgiven them for that. And if you think about it, that's fairly understandable. But the thing is that they actually went out and they reached out to the people, more so than the central government did. The central government was more or less run by warlords or other exiled, other, major figures that were living in exile, basically, and had, and like I said, they had no real boots on the ground when the Taliban took over back in the mid-90s. So there you go. So what does that mean for us? Well, here's the thing. Biden, in his speech, I think it was Tuesday actually, that he, Monday or Tuesday, where he came out basically saying that he did not want to pass this on to any future successors as president. Well, I got news for you. Well, I wouldn't, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to put it that way by saying I got news for you. Well, here's the thing. Biden is actually right to say that. The reason that he's right to be saying that, and the reason why he's actually right to be doing it, is because this is a 20-plus year conflict that basically was going nowhere. Afghanistan has been more or less in a civil war since the end of the 1970s. And it has no means of, and there's been no means of trying to quell it in a way that would bring all the factions together in a way that would make a lasting peace. And again, the much hated nation building again, it would not come back into fruition and, well, unless there was some kind of a political accord put into place. The Bush administration, when it first invaded Afghanistan in 01, did one thing that it really should not have, which was using the military to do state building, or shall we know more specifically, nation building. First of all, the military is not designed to do that. The military is not trained to do that. The military is mostly trained to, other than combat, well, besides combat, actually, is probably a better way to put that. The only thing that the military is basically trained for in any for in any basically in any particular, the only other function that it has basically is logistics, basically. That's the only thing that it's actually trained to do is handle logistics. And it's a very well-oiled machine in terms of doing that too. But yeah, whenever we send military, forces abroad, especially like when there's a natural disaster, it's to help with the logistics and such. We send hospital ships to help out with the, to help alleviate some of the local medical infrastructure, so this way it alleviates some of the pressure on it. We also at the same time send troops over to other countries, you know, like either National Guard or some other, or some other, you know, military form and whatnot, or another type of, you know, military contingent. Again, that's to handle the logistics of delivering and distributing aid. That, and again, that's what the military does, and it's very good at doing that. Nation building, on the other hand, is not their forte. That is the job of the Foreign Service, of the U.S. Foreign Service. That's their job. That is something called statescraft, which is what the State Department is actually trained to do. That's what our diplomatic corps is trained to do. Their job is to not only negotiate stuff, but it's also to form political accords. That's what they're trained to do. The only way you can get nation building again, as well as economy building again, you can't do it through the military. You have to do it first through a... You need to get all the factions together, and the only way you can get the factions together is through diplomats. Because that's what they're trained to do. And you need to use diplomats to negotiate a political accord. Once you have a political accord in place, everything else falls into place. Everything else more or less falls into line, basically. And so, and that's how you can get everything off the ground. And as I said before, the Bush administration never bothered to actually consider that. And so that's why Afghanistan was a massive failure. First of all, what do the Afghans have that we want? I mean, well, that's worthwhile at our ends for holding on to. Almost nothing, basically, because Afghanistan is not exactly a massive hotbed of natural resources. I mean, yeah, they do have a lot of land, and yeah, they do have some areas that they do have some pretty good, or they have some knowledge of trade roads that are right in there. But Afghanistan also has a long historic reputation for being the place where empires die. Afghanistan has long been known as the empire's graveyard, basically. The graveyard of empires. That's all I mean. I mean, think about it. The Macedonian, well, Alexander the Great's Macedonian Empire, Greco-Macedonian Empire, going from basically southeastern Europe all the way into Central Asia. You had the British Empire. You also had the Russian Empire. I don't know so much about the Persian Empire. I may need to do a little research on. But it, definitely some of the Turkish empires, definitely them. They tried also to conquer Afghanistan. They couldn't. And as a result, as I said, even the Mongol Empire even tried to go into Afghanistan. They couldn't either. But that's it. Again and again and again. One empire after another tried to conquer the place. They couldn't. They ended up, you know, collapsing because of it. First of all, there's a lot of terrain in there that's really difficult to hold on to. And if you have people there that are using guerrilla tactics, you're screwed, especially if you're using more conventional tactics, which is what we were doing, and that's why it backfired. so what does that do for America abroad? Well, specifically with its two main quote unquote, I wouldn't call them so much adversaries, but competitors. And by competitors, I mean Russia and China in particular, as well as, in some cases, Iran. So, what are they going to do? Well, are they going to try to go in there and clean the mess up? Not exactly. There's kind of a reason behind that. The biggest reason behind that is that if they try to wade in there, it's not going to get anywhere. The Taliban is going to push them out too. You see, the Taliban are mostly Sunnis. And the Sunnis and the Shiites have a long history of really, pounding each other into the ground for a very long time. Well, plus the Saudis are not going to allow that to happen anyway. But that aside, but the Russians or the Chinese don't really want to go in there because they don't want to get bogged down in there. And right now, with the Taliban having reclaimed power, they're nervous as hell. They are. They're very nervous because they're worried now that there's going to be like a mass exodus, basically, of anybody who is trying to escape the Taliban is going to come running into basically, well, in China in particular, it's going to be running. They're going to be running across the border, basically, and then they're going to have a massive refugee issue that they're going to have to deal with. So. Right now, when they had been trying to lobby for years and years and years for the Ameri you know, for the for you know, for the Americans and such to leave Afghanistan for, and I'm saying they were doing this for the better part of 2 decades. Now they're realizing that once the Americans aren't leaving, they're like, "Oh crap, what do we do now?" Maybe we ought to talk to the Americans. Maybe not about staying longer, but maybe we can. Perhaps we should at least talk with the Americans about seeing what we can do as on a regional basis, and see if they can get in some other regional partners. So this way, we can finally get all the factions. Basically, to quit fighting with each other. That's what you're going to start seeing, basically, is the Russians and the Chinese, they're going to start quietly approaching the Americans about putting together some kind of a regional pact, basically, or getting all the regional powers together and putting together some kind of political accord to get all the factions together. That's what I think is going to mostly. That's what I think what's going to end up happening, basically. Instead of another nation trying to go in there to impose its will through trying to end up fighting by imposing its will on the people, because that's not going to work. And 20 years of fighting in Afghanistan has certainly shown that. Now. Now, what does this mean for Joe Biden? Well, besides the whole Afghanistan debacle, well, first of all, attitudes towards Biden are starting to cool down, but that's expected. I mean, the 9-month honeymoon phase of a new president in office. Like I said, you get a 9-month honeymoon, and then you get 3.25 years of having to slog things out. So, I know there's a lot of doom and gloom predictions for the Democrats in terms of the midterms, and that's understandable. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, think about it. Think about how for the better part of, I would say, 2 centuries, the out party tends to do well in midterm elections. 2022 is not going to be any exception to that. And after all of that happens, well, but here's the thing. What could potentially happen too is that if the Democrats get a lucky enough break where they manage to get something that actually shows full well that the Republicans have had some kind of foreknowledge about this or were involved in the planning, that could change the dynamic very, very quickly. And so the Democrats could pull off a rarity that's only happened maybe about 4 times in American history, where the in party makes gains in the midterm election. Like I said, that's only happened about 4 times in American history: 1806, 1818, 1934, and again in 2002. Those are the 4 instances where the in party actually made gains in both congressional chambers. We could also have a split situation where the Republicans make gains in the House of Representatives, but the Democrats make gains in the Senate, basically. And that's happened before. Oh, I would say several more times than that. Then the situation where they get both chambers in where the in party gets holds makes gains in both chambers. So that's another thing that could end up playing out. But what does that mean for 2024? That's the biggest question. That's actually the question we really should be asking ourselves. A good chunk of the Republican governors that are in power right now, some of them, even if they don't have the support of, even if they have the support of the party's base, they don't have the support of the majority of their state's electorate. And I'm talking about states like, Florida with Ron DeSantis, or Texas with Greg Abbott. Those two are in very critical danger of losing their seats basically next year. And if the Democrats pick up those two gubernatorial seats, that changes the dynamic in terms of, in case if the Republicans do a gerrymander, the Democrats, if they take control of it basically, and if they make some strident gains in both of those states, legislatures too, it might be enough for them to do a whole redistricting again, to do a second round of redistricting, and this time make it on a basis of racial balance, or at least make it a balance where, or make it so this way they're not quite as skewed to one party over the other, basically, is another way of putting that. Or it could go the opposite direction too, because the Democratic governor in New York at the moment, Andrew Cuomo, is about to get impeached, or is very close to facing impeachment, basically. And then in my home state of California, well, let's just say that there's a bit of recall election that's about to go through in a couple of weeks. And when that happens against its governor, Gavin Newsom is, I mean, he's vulnerable, but he's not. But luckily, he does still have a majority of the state backing him up. Because most of the people here, or most of the people in California, view the situation there as the Republican, or more specifically, the National Republican Party, as trying to basically, as trying to usurp control of it, just because they can't seem to get their act together by funding, by fielding candidates that are, actually somewhat mainstream and not out on the fringes. But I can't be bothered about that. So whatever happens to Gavin Newsom remains to be seen, actually. So what may end up happening is that if Gavin Newsom does get recalled and a Republican is elected in his place, what does that mean? Well, here's what that's going to end up happening. The Republican is probably going to guide the party in a way so that they could try to get back control of the state, government basically in some form or another, which they could do theoretically. Or basically, what that could also do is that could also mean that the independent commission that California has for redistricting, they'll stack it with right-wing ideologues. And when that happens, they'll be able to shift it around to where the Republican Party actually starts winning, at least on the ground in several congressional districts, as well as the legislative districts. And once they get control of the legislature, they're gonna pass legislation that makes it so this way it should be that so that it's impossible to vote, and then it'll drive down, basically it'll drive down turnout, and it'll cause people to, and when turnout goes down, Republicans, the chances for Republicans to win go up, and the Republicans could potentially, although I'm not saying that they will, but this gives them the potentiality for carrying my home state, California. And if they take control of the state government in New York, same story. Or in any of these other Democratic-controlled states, same story. They'll be able to pull that off. Now, if they can control the state governments, what does that mean for the federal government? It means that if Joe Biden, and so far he's showing indications in one form or another that he is not going to run again, that he's not going to run for re-election in 2024. I don't. Biden has shown time and again through his own actions that he's not considering re-election, and that come 2024 he's going to stand down. However, even if he does run again in 2024, and the Republicans get a control of basically, and I'm not saying that they will get control of all 50 state governments, but let's just. But let's just say, for argument's sake, that they do. Just theoretically. What does that entail? Well, here's what this would entail. It could be a theoretical 50-state blowout for Trump, who is going to run again in 2024. He's going to gain and I guarantee you this, he runs again in 2024, he's going to gain the Republican Party's nomination for president. That's just a given. And with enough of the vote eliminate or drive by driving turnout down, he gets a straight shot back into the presidency again, and we have to deal with him for another 4 years again. Now, are the Republicans going to try to change around the Constitution so this way he could run indefinitely? Of course they will. That's one of the most idiotic questions to ask. Of course they're going to do it. Since the Republican Party right now, they don't have a platform. They don't stand for anything. It's just the whims of a thrice divorced con job who sweet talked them into backing them up. What's it going to be with Trump in the White House again for another 4 years? Let me put it this way. It's going to be 40 more years of incompetence. Now, bear in mind the fact, yeah, he is going to go after civil rights. Yeah, he is going to try to escalate all the white supremacy and whatnot. He is going to try to escalate everything else, so bring up the extreme right wing into the presence again. But the fact is that that's all fine and dandy, but the main thing you got to keep an eye out for is not so much what he's doing publicly, it's what he's doing on the inside, or what he's allowing to happen on the inside. By bringing in people that are clearly not qualified for the positions that they're being appointed to, what he's doing is he's creating a situation where people lose confidence in the in the various institutions that we had been building up for nearly three centuries. If that is allowed to happen, then you're going to set up a situation where you're going to get a dictatorship. And that is essentially what Trump wants to be. He wants to be he's basically a wannabe dictator, albeit a very incompetent one. But he is a wannabe dictator, basically. It also sets up the ground for where the Republicans at this point, since they don't have a platform and they really don't have a leg that they can actually stand on, or since they don't stand for anything, they're just for taking power for the sake of having it. There's an old quote from the 92 election from the Democratic Party's chairman at the time, which said that the Republican Party is the party that wants power but then doesn't know what it wants to do once it has it. Basically, I mean, other than giving tax cuts to its wealthy donors and whatnot, and basically going on a spending spree without bringing in some kind of revenue and exploding the national debt every time they're in office. The fact is that you lead yourself into a situation where, yeah. There's no accountability. The fact of the matter is that there's this old mantra that says that Democrats can't govern. Let me do a slight tweak of that and reiterate it in a slightly different way. It's not that Democrats can't govern, it's that Republicans don't govern. It's true. Republicans really don't govern. They don't even bother at this point. So, but yeah, that's essentially what it's going to be. It's going to be another four, or in some cases, indefinite years of just endemic corruption, basically, ongoing violence, plus all racialized stuff and whatnot. The only way that you're going to be able to kill it is if you start attacking what's driving people to even embrace that kind of thing. That is what Joe Biden is trying to do. Joe Biden knows what is driving it. A lot of it is just desperation, basically, and anger on the part of the people who are basically being stomped on. Joe Biden can reach those people very, very easily, actually, or he's shown that he can, or he's shown that he can relate with them, which again is kind of his saving grace in more forms than not. But the thing that you got to do is you need to attack all of what is causing all the pressure and such on the people and start to alleviate it from the bottom up. Which means passing an infrastructure bill, which is in the process of going through things right now. You need to update what it means, what infrastructure actually means, rather from being simply roads and bridges to, as he said, you know, universal child care, that's for starters. In home care, especially for those who can't take care of themselves. Let me think, what else is there? It is, you know, updating a lot of the schools that are there, you know, getting out all the lead, paste paint, getting all the asbestos out as the, not the filling, it's, as the insulation, basically, so. But yeah, that's essentially what that is, basically, is getting all of that together, plus, you know, universal broadband, that's another one, or expanding broadband internet in rural areas. You know, area, you know, investments where that most of the ISPs at the moment, you know, the internet service providers, they're not willing to do because to them it's just simply too expensive to do. Their argument is that it's too expensive and it's not worth spending the money to do it. Also, they're a little too adept to figure out how to do it, but that's a whole different story. Not the people that are in there themselves, no. It's just the companies at large that are just way too adept about that. So, you have that. You have the And also what is going on too is that there is a growing awareness of the fact that people left and right are getting also really tired of the fact that no, you know, that there's a also being sidelined constantly, which is exactly what's going on right now, too. The other thing that we're going to also have to do is make sure that people have the ability to make their voices heard, and currently the Republicans are trying to do everything they can to make sure that is not the case, especially at the state level. And but anyway, yeah, I mean, there's quite a bit of that going on. Plus, speaking of Trump, as I was kind of ignoring him for the longest time, and I realized ignoring him is kind of not exactly a good thing. Here's why. The fact is that Trump is in a lot of legal jeopardy right now, too. And so for him running for president in 2024, if you think about it, it actually makes a lot of sense. The moment he's president is the moment that he can shut all that down. Or at least he'll be in a position where he can at least try to shut it down. The fact is that he is in a lot of legal jeopardy right now, especially not just concerning the, it's not just the whole thing with the, the January 6th uprising and whatnot. It's not just that. I mean, that's part of it, but it's not the entirety of it. The other problem that is coming from that is that the other thing, though, is the fact that he also has a lot of potential foreign investments through the Trump Organization and a lot of other debts that the Trump Organization has accrued over the years. And it's coming very close to the point where those debts need to be paid off. The due date for paying the debts off is coming up pretty quickly. And so him saying that he's going to run in 2024, when he runs in 2024, he could put it off again. And when he wins, and should he win the presidency in 2024, I'm not saying that he will, but, oh no, actually, I did kind of say earlier that he will, in one form or another. But in the event that he does win, he'll be able to push it off again to the point where no one can really hold him accountable for it. Now, one of the biggest factors that we're going to have to also worry about with Trump is, again, is figuring out what to do, it's to keep not him specifically out of there, but it's also to prevent another, well, here's how I see it. Trump is more of the symptom instead of the cause of us. It's like I said before in a number of my previous casts. Trump is not the problem, or he's not the cause of the problem. He's the symptom. He's the result. He's the effect of the problem. The biggest problem is you need to change the way that the fundamentals are working, or otherwise you're going to be in a situation where it's going to be like how it was in pre-revolutionary France, basically. You know, the haves and the have-nots. And when you find yourself in that situation, it's like I said before, it's you're just asking for a violent insurrection to pop up. And I would hate to see that here. But luckily, I think we're in enough of a position where we're not quite at that point yet, but we're pretty close to it. We did manage to dodge a bullet in January 2021. We did manage to, like I said, we dodged the bullet, but barely. And so there's a bunch of right-wing conspiracists right now saying, like, oh, well, you know, in August this, in September that, blah, 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 blah. I mean, look, they're going to be squawking left and right. First of all, here's what I'm going to tell you. Pay them a little bit. Pay them no mind. They, a lot of them, they're just squawking just to make themselves heard. Especially that my pillow guy, Mike Little, basically. So like I said, don't take their squawking too literally, you know, or just take it with a slight grain of salt, basically. But Individually, they're nothing. But if they're going to continue to hawk this time and again and again and again, it's going to make it so this way the most avid Trump supporters feel that it is time to launch another violent insurrection again. Now, is Trump going to blackmail some other foreign power into backing him up? Of course he is. That's been the MO, more or less, of Republican presidential candidates who have won. The last five Republican presidents who were elected into office, Gerald Ford being some, you could make a quasi case that he was appointed, basically. But so, aside from Ford, basically, going from Nixon to Reagan to the Bushes and then Trump. Each time, guess what? There was a foreign power backing them up. The biggest problem, and that's the thing though, is that the Republican Party, it's not so much the individual candidates that you got to be worried about for president. They're not the ones you got to be looking at. It's the party itself you need to look at. The fact is that the party has a quote-unquote, well, they don't have much of a platform other than tax breaks for the very wealthy and not just more deregulation, but also. It's also essentially mass military spending and military adventures. That's what the Republican Party more or less stands for. Now, that does not resonate with about 80% of the electorate. Most of the electorate does not want that. Now, the Republican, now the you think the party isn't aware of that? Of course they know that. Of course it knows. It's known that for years. The only way you could get into power with that, other than restricting, access to the vote, access to voting, is through colluding with a is by is through colluding with a foreign power. And the last five Republican presidents that have been elected into office, each one of them has colluded with the party at large has colluded with a foreign power. That's been the case time and time again. So when the whole debacle happened with Ukraine, it's like I said before, Ukraine. What happened was it wasn't so much that the that Trump got caught, it was that the party got caught with its pants down. But that's the thing, is that the party knows offhand that it's responsible for a lot of what's going on, and they're trying to deflect or change the subject, basically, is what they're doing. We can't let them do that, and we need to do everything we can to basically hold them accountable. I mean, yeah, we do need to hold the Democrats accountable since they're the quote-unquote leaders of the government at the moment. But we cannot take our eyes off the Republicans. The Republicans, we need to keep an eye on them. It's just that simple. Anyway, I know I've been talking for almost an hour, so I am going to kill it here. I want to say thanks for doing, thanks for listening. I'm JGSF 1987, and I am out of here.